भद्रं कर्णे भी शृणुयाम देवा भद्रं पश्येमाक्षभीर्यजत्राः स्थिरैरङ्गैस्तुष्टवागुंसस्तनूभिः व्यशेम देवहितं यदायुः स्वस्ति न इन्द्रो वृद्धश्रवाः स्वस्ति नः पूषा विश्ववेदाः स्वस्ति नस्तार्क्ष्यो अरिष्टनेमिः स्वस्ति नो बृहस्पतिर्दधातु। ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः। The translation is, O gods, may we hear auspicious words with our ears while engaged in sacrifices. May we see auspicious things with our eyes while praising the gods with steady limbs. May we enjoy a life that is beneficial to the gods. May Indra of ancient fame be auspicious to us. May the all-knowing Pusha, god of the earth, be propitious to us. May Garuda, the destroyer of evil, be well disposed towards us. May Brihaspati ensure our welfare. Om, peace, peace, peace. I was just reminded the importance of stillness. So here there is a phrase used, sthirairangaihi. It means with strong, healthy, long-lasting, limbs and sense organs and all of that, which is necessary for any kind of religion, any kind of spirituality, in fact, any kind of worldly activity, of course. But sthira also means steady, not restless, not shaky. I was just reminded many, many years ago, this was over 30 years ago, when I had just joined the order as a novice. We were sitting down, we used to sit on a mat on the floor to study, and the Swami who was teaching us. One day I remember a friend of mine, another novice, is sitting and fidgety, sort of shaking. And the Swami immediately sharply scolded him. He said, "Stop that." That means still. Sthirairangehi. The mind is so delicately balanced that any shaking of the body, it disturbs the mind. It's like a bowl of water. If you shake the bowl, even if your hand trembles a little bit, the water moves a lot. So you have to hold it really carefully. Therefore, physical stillness. I've seen in many of the senior monks, those advanced practitioners, this quality of stillness. All right. Now, where were we? We were on the very end of the Mundaka, almost the end of the Mundaka Upanishad, which is the third chapter. The chapters are called Mundakas, and each chapter has two sections. So we were towards the end of the first section of the third chapter. And the verse that we were doing is the eighth verse. We did the eighth verse last time, but just to catch up, because I was away, the eighth verse goes like this, eighth mantra. न चक्षुषा गृह्यते नापि वाचा नान्ये देवै तपसा कर्मणा वा ज्ञानप्रसादेन विशुद्धसत्त्वा ततस्तुतं पश्यते निष्कलं ध्यायमानः। What does this mean? So this chapter, it talks about the preliminary preparations or practices necessary for enlightenment. Practices like ethical life and austerity, and concentration of mind, truth, self-control, these are strength, moral, physical strength, emotional strength, so strength. All of these things are important for as preparatory, as foundational for enlightenment, for spiritual life also. Here, it says that because of the extreme subtlety of the Atman, what we are trying to realize, And that's being pointed out. And the chapter also will talk about the results of self-knowledge a little later. So what is being pointed out, because the extreme subtlety of the Atman, nachakshusha grihyate, you cannot realize, you cannot know this Atman, our real nature, with your eyes. Of course, you cannot see it. Somebody asked me, in fact, just today, somebody asked me that this pure consciousness we talk about, is it ever possible to have experience of that? Now, clearly, what you mean by experience of that is somewhere inside us is this is what we are experiencing. See, we're seeing it. So, can we experience it like that? Obviously, the questioner did not mean something as crude as seeing it with the eyes, but the principle is the same. You cannot objectify it because it is the very nature of the subject, it's the essence or the reality of the subject. Na chakshusha agriyate, not by the eyes, and by extension, none of the sense organs. It says, na nei devehi, not by the any other. The devatas here refer to the other sense organs. Devatas means literally the gods, small g, but here it refers to the various sense powers. So, yes, the self cannot be seen, heard, smelt, tasted, touched. Na api vacha. It cannot be revealed by speech. So we have discussed this. It comes up once in a while that how is the real nature of the Atman, pure consciousness, beyond speech and beyond mind. You cannot speak about it. You cannot think about, conceive of it. And why we cannot speak about it, I've also mentioned what is necessary for speech to operate and why those characteristics are not present in the featureless, attributeless, pure consciousness. And also, when we use words like Atman, pure consciousness, Brahman, we fail to refer. Refer means when I use a word like a notebook, I mean this. When I use a word like cloth, I mean this. So it refers, the word refers to something. So when you say pure consciousness, Atman, Brahman, what is it that you're referring to? The words themselves will not directly refer to anything. It has to be caught. So language is used here in a very strategic way in the Upanishads. So multiple strategies are adopted to refer to something that cannot be directly referred to indicate something. So if you cannot speak about the Atman, at least you can say what it is not. If you can't say what it is, you can say what it is not. The famous neti neti, not this approach. Or paradoxical language is sometimes used. Or implication is sometimes used. Or stories are sometimes used to indicate our real nature. Multiple techniques are used where language fails. Karmanava. None of the Vedic sacrificial rituals, the Vedic rituals which those people were used to, what they normally thought of as religion, none of them will help you to, will show you the real nature of the self. None of them will lead to enlightenment. Then, what will help? Purification of the mind. It says, Vishuddha Sattva, purified mind. So what it actually practically means is everything that was rejected in this first line, the religious practices, austerities, control of the senses, those might not directly reveal the Atman to you, but religious practices, moral practices, all of them are essential to prepare the mind. What will they do? They will give us purity of mind. Then purity of mind, you combine it with Vedantic instruction, these teachings of the Upanishads. A competent teacher, you study the texts and then contemplate on it, then get clarity and meditate. So, Shravana Manana Nididhyasana of Vedanta with a prepared mind. Prepared mind is a purified mind. And purification of the mind, all the other practices, truth, strength of mind, purity of mind, self-control, austerities, all of them become relevant. So just because it says by religious rituals you cannot become enlightened, one shouldn't abandon one's spiritual practices, or even devotional practices. All of them are useful. Now, Jnana prasadena. So, what is proximally useful? What will directly lead to enlightenment? Jnana prasadena. By a purified mind in which knowledge arises. How will knowledge arise? By the use of Vedanta, by Shravana Manana Nididhyasana, by listening to the Vedantic teachings, by thinking carefully about it, and then once clarity is gained, staying with that clarity. Shankaracharya here, to explain Jnana Prasadena, he explains how purity of mind and Vedanta operate together to give enlightenment. He gives the example, two nice examples, that of the mirror and that of the water. So in both, one can see the reflection of one's face. And he gives it's a very nice example because one's face is always present. The face is always present, but to see the face, it's not enough to just have the face present. You need a mirror. And it's not enough to just have the mirror. You have to clean the mirror. Then only the face is reflected there. So to experience, to realize who I am, you need the mind. Although the mind cannot directly see it, but you need the mind. And the mind has to be purified. Another example he gives is of water. You can see your face in the water, but the water needs to be steady. And he gives that example. And then he gives the contrary, the problems. He says a dirty mirror will not reflect or reflect properly. Or he says restless water, water which is breaking out into ripples, that will not reflect. It will break up the reflection. He has given this very nice example. He says, Atma avabodhana samartham api swabhavena sarva praninam jnanam. He says, self-realization, the mind is possible, mind is capable of attaining enlightenment, atmajnana, self-realization. Swabhavena, naturally capable. The mind is naturally capable. Mirror is naturally capable of reflecting our face. And then he says, sarva praninam, of all beings. He doesn't even say of all human beings. He says, all beings, the mind is capable. Then, but what's the problem? Bahya vishaya ragadi dosha kalushitam aprasannam ashuddham san navabodhayati. Once the mind is polluted, is conditioned by attraction and repulsion, he says specifically attraction to sense objects of things in the world. Once it's pulled outwards, then it becomes incapable of revealing to us our real nature. Nityam sannihitam api. He says, although it's constantly, most proximally present, all the time, like our face is present. The mirror, which is capable of naturally capable of reflecting my face, but once it gets a coating of dust, it cannot. It's obstructed. Although the face is constantly present. So that's the beautiful thing about Vedanta. What we are talking about here, what we are trying to realize here, is constantly available to us. It's saying that the best things in life are always free. So sunlight and air and water and just nature, all of it is free. But, and so also, even more so, freely, all the time, without condition, available is the highest realization, the greatest fulfillment of human life. And, that's really fair of God. All the lesser and useless things you can struggle for, you can attain for some time and then lose it. Things in the world, people and relationships and money and success and power and wealth, life itself will come and go. They are lesser things, much lesser things. The highest thing is all the time available to us, that is Atman or Brahman. And that's a great comfort. Even if I do not see, it's a great comfort to know that Brahman, the Atman of my real nature, is constantly, unconditionally, effortlessly, directly available to us. All the effort is to clean the mirror. Swami Vivekananda says in one place, rather cryptically, all we can do is polish the mirror. All we can do is polish the mirror. And this is what he means. Sannihitam api, it's constantly present. It's not separated from you by space. It's right here. It's not separated from you by time. You don't have to wait for it. It's right now. And it's not something else. It's you. मला अनवद्धम, मला अवनद्धम, सॉरी मला अवनद्धम, ऑब्स्ट्रक्टेड, कवर्ड बाय इम्प्योरिटीज, इव, सो ही सेज एज इफ लाइक अ मिरर कवर्ड बाय डर्ट. देन ही गिव्स अनदर एग्जाम्पल, विलूलितम इव सलीलम, डिस्टर्ब एज इट वे द वॉटर्स. When you look into the waters and see, want to see your face, you cannot because it's shaking. It's someone is fidgeting. If you fidget the body, then he goes on to say, once the attraction for external objects, the actually the disturbance created in the mind by the attraction for an external objects. The restlessness of the mind, these are removed. That is called Jnana Prasada. So the purity of the mind leading to the rising of self-knowledge. So then that leads to self-knowledge. And then he says, what do you see then? Pashyati, he sees. Sees, of course, quote unquote, because you don't actually see. He just denied that you cannot see it by the eyes. So you don't actually see. You know, but you don't actually really know it by the mind. It's called Brahmakara vritti, the arising of the mental modification about the true nature of the Atman, where that mental modification destroys our ignorance about the Atman, and the Atman is ever shining, so it gets revealed. It's just like lifting a veil, and the reality is already there. Yeah, that's a good example. All our efforts and the final moment of illumination, what the mind does is it basically lifts the veil. It does not reveal the truth. It lifts the veil. The truth is always available, not only available, always shining forth, always self-revealed. From the side of the truth, from the side of Atman, from the side of Brahman, none remains to be done. Brahman is doing all it can. Atman, our real nature, is doing all it can to show itself to us. It's we who have complicated things, and we require effort to see ourselves. And it sounds paradoxical, but that's the way it is. Nishkalam, the partless. Here, the ultimate reality, our nature, is called Nishkalam, partless. Partless means, technically, it means Swagata, Vijatiya, Sajatiya, Bhedarahita, devoid of the threefold difference. Threefold difference. This Atman, Brahman, there is nothing other than it. So Vijatiya Bheda. So maybe, so there's a book. Here is a book. And there are other things. The table and the chair and the person, they're all other than the book. This is called Vijatiya Bheda. Difference of dissimilar things. So there are no dissimilar things, but there is only the Atman. The second kind of difference is, one might say, okay, there's the Atman, but are there many Atmans? There's only consciousness, but are there many consciousnesses? No. Sajatiya Bheda, the difference of similar kinds. So this is a book, surely, but this is also another book. Is it like that? Are there many a book like many books? Are there many Atmans? No. There's only the same one Atman. So Swagata Bheda. All right. But within the Atman, just like within this book, there are pages, different pages. Within the Atman, or say within the same table, it has a top, it has a bottom, it has four legs. Within the Atman, are there different parts? Does consciousness have parts? This refers to Vishishtadvaita. They will say yes, but here it says no nishkalam. It has no parts at all. It's one homogeneous pure consciousness. So this is what partless means, devoid of the three kinds of difference. Difference within itself, ultimate reality has no internal difference within itself, no parts. And then there's no part or whole relationship there. Second, there are no multiple ultimate realities, there's only one. And third, there is nothing other than that ultimate reality. So these three kinds of differences are denied. This is a denial of the three, negation of the three kinds of differences. It's all of that is packed into one word, ultimate reality is nishkalam, partless, dhyayamana, being meditated upon. So Shankaracharya says dhyayamana means the mind purified by ethical practices and internalized, turned inwardized and concentrated, ekagrena manasa. Dhyayamana literally means meditation. Here he translates it anuchintayan, thinking after. What is thinking after? First you hear it, study it, get the knowledge from the, what the Upanishads are talking about. Second, remove all doubts so the intellect has absolute clarity about what we are talking about here. And then stay with that absolute clarity. That is Vedantic meditation. Shankaracharya, he says it's just anuchintan. It's like careful and deep sustained thinking. The thinking, not in the sense of a rational inquiry, which is the second step, which is mananam. But that's already done. Now clarity has been attained. What you have attained clarity with, stay with that. That is called dhyayamana. So this is the eighth mantra. We already done this, but I just wanted to bring forth. I don't remember if I bought the for the lake example, the water example, and the mirror example. Shankaracharya uses those two beautiful examples. And those examples are instructive. The mirror by itself is capable of reflecting the face, but not when it is covered by dust. Similarly, the mind by itself is capable of attaining enlightenment quite easily, but not when it is impure. So purification of the mind is indicated here, like polishing the mirror. The other problem with the mind when it seeks enlightenment is restlessness of the mind, and that is shown by the restless waters. The water you can automatically reflect our face, but not when it is breaking out into ripples and waves. The water is stilled, the mirror is polished, so the mind is purified and the mind is calmed, stilled and inwardized, not flowing out continuously. Then it is ready for enlightenment. This is what is meant by preparation, by purification of the mind. Now, the next mantra, number 9. Esho anuratma cetasa veditavyo yasmin prana panchadasam vivesha praneschittam sarvamotam prajanam yasmin vishuddhe vibhavatyesha atma. Let me just read the English translation from Swami Gambhirananda. Within the heart and the body, where the vital forces entered in five forms, is this subtle self to be realized through that intelligence by which is pervaded the entire mind as well as the motor and sensory organs of all creatures. And it is to be known in the mind, which having become purified, this self reveals itself distinctly. Okay. Esha anuratma. What are we talking about? Here, the self is described as anu. Anu literally means atom, tiny. But here it doesn't mean tiny because the self has, we have already realized, we have already been taught, it's limitless, it's vast. It's vaster than the entire universe. The poet Emily Dickinson, she writes, "The brain in itself is greater than the sky, is vaster than the sky." I'm paraphrasing, I've forgotten the actual language. She doesn't mean the physical brain, she means consciousness. It is vaster than the sky because it is in consciousness. The sky and the earth and people, the great and the small, are all seen, are all experienced. We think that doesn't make sense because the sky is outside and it's really big. So what if it is seen in consciousness? It's outside and it's seen. But Vedanta says it's not outside. It's not outside. It is appeared, the whole thing is an appearance in consciousness. As the Tibetan Buddhists put it, very nice language, they say, like a magical display, a dreamlike appearances on the primordial ground. Dreamlike appearances on the primordial ground. Yes. Rick is prompt as ever. He has given us the poem. Beautiful poem. The brain is wider than the sky, for put them side by side, the one the other will contain with ease, and you beside. Consciousness will contain you and the sky. The brain is deeper than the sea, for hold them blue to blue, the one the other will absorb as sponges, buckets do. The brain is just the weight of God. Beautiful. For heft them, pound for pound, and they will differ if they do as syllable from sound. Beautifully done. It's so Vedantic. It even ends with the identity of the self and God. The brain and God, it says, it weighs as much as God. So Anu, it's tiny, tiny. It's not tiny in that sense of the little. It's actually vast, but it's Anu in the sense of subtle. Just as an atom is subtle, it's very subtle. It's not a physical thing. It's not a vital thing. It's not a mental thing. It's not an intellectual concept. It's nothing. It's not nothing either. It's subtler than nothing. It hides behind the veil of nothingness. Anuratma. How are we supposed to realize it, know it at all? The Swami Vivekananda says it's not something that can be known, but it's don't go away with the idea that it is unknown. It's more than known. Chetasa veditabhya. It has to be realized through the mind, the prepared mind. What is the preparation? We've already seen. Purified and concentrated. It must be purified of impurities. And the restlessness of the mind must be stilled. Yasmin prana panchada samvivesha, in which body? Here, he is drawing our attention to the body. And he says, in this body, pay attention to the body. Then, where the pranas course through this body, in a living body, prana. Prana is the vital forces. And panchada, fivefold. So we have read in Vedanta Sara, the fivefold prana. Basically, five functions of the vital forces: prana, apana, vyana, udana, samana. So these five functions of the vital forces, which keep this body alive. Then it says, "Pranishchittam sarvam otam prajanam," of all living beings. The vital forces, the senses, the mind, they're all pervaded by this one consciousness. Basically, one consciousness is reflected in the subtle body. The technical terms which we use, physical body, subtle body, causal body. So the whole consciousness, of course, pervades everything, but it is particularly reflected in the what is called the subtle body. So again, all these sound is esoteric, but if you take a look, each of us, if you just look inside, yes, we feel sentient. We all feel aware. This awareness is not pure consciousness. It arises and it waxes and wanes and it disappears every day. This awareness which we have right now, it is the consciousness reflected in the waking mind. When the mind goes to sleep, consciousness will be reflected in the dreaming mind. But when the mind goes to deep sleep, then the reflected consciousness also is not functional anymore. But that's why we feel awareness is gone. Yes, this reflected awareness is gone temporarily, but pure consciousness is always there. Now, here it says that the consciousness is reflected in the subtle body, in our mind and intellect and senses everywhere. It's pointing to something we are all aware of right now. Yasmin vishuddhe vibhavatyesha atma, in which purified and concentrated mind. Vishuddhe means concentrated mind. Vibhavatyesha atma, the self, this self, the pure self, this very subtle self, the self which is as subtle as an atom, but as vast, as she said, as the sky and as deep as the ocean, And as heavy, as hefty as God, that consciousness will be revealed in the prepared mind, the purified mind. It says Vibhavati shines forth. There, we have to see here what is being indicated. The Brahmakara vritti, which I mentioned earlier, this is being indicated here. The moment of enlightenment, what exactly happens? How is self-knowledge, enlightenment, different from other knowledge? So what is knowledge from a Vedantic perspective? What happens in knowledge, any kind of knowledge, when we see, hear, smell, taste, and so on, when we think, when we understand, what's happening? What's happening is that when I take up any object, like a book, so the eyes focus on the book, and there is a vritti, a wave in the mind about the book, about what I'm reading. Or not just a wave, a continuous series of waves in the mind about what I'm reading. And the consciousness, which is always there, pure consciousness, you yourself, you are reflected in the mind as the reflected consciousness. That illumines the waves in the mind. So when the waves in the mind about what we are reading, how did it come about? Through the eyes, information comes, and then the mind breaks out into waves, processing that information. Those waves are illumined by the consciousness already reflected there. And that gives us knowledge. So two things are necessary for ordinary knowledge, all kinds of knowledge which we have in the world. When we are continuously operating in the world, we have all kinds of knowledge. It requires the mind to be focused on the object of knowledge, mind, basically the mind to be thinking about the object of knowledge, and the reflected consciousness there to illumine the movements of the mind. So when the mind objectifies the object of knowledge, thinks about it, focuses on it, a vritti, and technically there is a vritti. This vritti technically is called vritti vyapti. The mind pervades, literally it means the mind pervades the object of knowledge. Whatever you are trying to know, the mind pervades it means the mind is thinking about it. Now, little footnote here that traditional Vedantic epistemology will say the mind goes out through the senses and actually pervades the object of knowledge. We will not go into those. It's more theological than epistemologically convincing. But what we are just saying, the mind is thinking about what we are trying to know. The moment the mind thinks about whatever you're trying to know, there's a particular wave, and the wave has for its content, the mind has it for its content, the object of knowledge. So far, so good. But the direct experience of, I know this, I understand this, I am reading this, the kind of experience we are all having all the time. This experience comes from the reflected consciousness. The reflected consciousness is there, and then it reveals, it illumines the wave in the mind. So when the reflected consciousness illumines the wave in the mind with its content, this is called phalavyapti, pervasion by consciousness. So, putting it together, all knowledge from a Vedantic perspective, any kind of knowledge, has these two components: vritti-vyapti, pervasion by the mind, literally meaning thinking by the mind focusing on whatever you want to know, and phalavyapti, pervasion by reflected consciousness. These two things are necessary. And remember, the reflected consciousness, of course, implies that pure consciousness is always present. Now, what about enlightenment? In enlightenment, we are not trying to know a book or a flower or something in the world or even the body. In enlightenment, we are trying to realize pure subject itself, which is not an object. So the mind, when it is well trained by Vedanta, when it is inwardized, we'll see the process of inwardization now. When it's inwardized, then it finally settles upon its real nature. It cannot objectify, but that moment of non-objective, sort of intuitive realization that comes, and the reflected consciousness is no longer necessary to reveal it, because now you're talking about, now you're trying to realize something that is self-luminous, consciousness itself. All other things are objects to consciousness. As long as we want, forms are objects, sounds are objects, smell, taste, flavor, all of these are objects. And when we try to understand them, even concepts are objects. Memories are objects, desires are objects. To know them, we need the mind plus the reflected consciousness. But the original consciousness itself, pure consciousness itself, is not an object, and it does not require reflected consciousness to be known or to be revealed. Let's say, not to be known, to be revealed. It's like the sunlight. And with the help of the sunlight, the eyes can see everything in the world. Now, the example would be when we reflect the sunlight. I've given the example of a mirror or a steel plate by which we reflect the sunlight, and the reflected beam goes into a dark corner of the room and shows us what's there in the world. But the sun itself, you don't need to reflect the sunlight from a polished mirror or a surface back to the sun to see the sun. The sun is blazing forth with millions of times more light than that, and even the reflected light is the light of the sun. So to know yourself as pure consciousness, you need to turn the mind and focus it with the help of purification and Vedanta, and then you, the Atman, will reveal yourself to yourself, which is going on all the time, which is all the time available. In another way, what Vedanta is doing, what does the mind do? It removes the veil of ignorance. And in normal cases, the mind removes the veil of ignorance, and the reflected consciousness gives us knowledge. If something is hidden behind a veil, we need the hand to remove the veil, then the eyes will see. Similarly, the Atman is hidden by the veil of ignorance, not a physical veil. You need the mind to remove that veil. Then consciousness reveal is always self-revealed. You don't need a reflected consciousness anymore in this case. So that is the meaning of vibhavati esha atma. For those who remember the technical terms, vritti vyapti, phala vyapti, for ordinary knowledge, vritti vyapti and phala vyapti both are necessary, pervasion by mind, pervasion by reflected consciousness. For enlightenment, for realization of Atman or Brahman, self-knowledge, only vritti vyapti, pervasion by mind, is necessary. What is that? How do you get that? Through the Shravana Manana Nididhyasana, through the study and hearing of Vedanta, through contemplation, reasoning and contemplation, and through meditation. So only vritti vyapti is necessary, but phala vyapti, reflected consciousness, is not necessary. That's why again and again you will find across the Upanishads, across Vedanta, it is beyond the mind. The mind cannot reach there. Yes, in what sense is it beyond the mind? In the sense that phala vyapti, reflected consciousness, is not necessary. But sometimes you will find in the Upanishads, only by the mind it can be known. Here, throughout the Upanishads, throughout this particular Upanishad, it keeps saying, in that purified mind it is reflected, or in the purified mind it is realized. That means by the mind it can be known. It says by the pure mind it can be known. So it can be known by the pure mind. How do you reconcile these two contradictory statements? It can be known by the mind, it cannot be known by the mind. It cannot be known by the mind technically, because phalabhyapti is not necessary. Pervasion by reflected consciousness, not necessary. It can be known by the mind because vritti vyapti is necessary. Pervasion by the mind is necessary. Here, Shankaracharya's commentary, yasmincha chitte, in that mind, kleshadi malai viyukte, shuddhe, in the purified mind. What is purified? When all the negativities, desires, repulsions, they have been scrubbed clean, they have been purified. Vibhavati blazes forth, shines. Ukta Atma, said, the said Atman, the said self, which has been mentioned so far, which has been taught so far. How does it blaze forth? It's an important point he makes. Visheshena svena atmana vibhavati. As I am that. It doesn't blaze forth as, this is pure consciousness. Oh, now I see Brahman. No, now this is Brahman. I found it. It's just like poking around in the body. A doctor finds the liver or the heart or the kidney. Now I have found Brahman. No. It's not like a memory when you are thinking, I just can't recall it. Oh, I've got it now. I located the memory. It comes to mind now. No, not like that. It shines forth as, I am this. Right now it's shining forth also, but as I am this body. I am this person. I am just this guy. Then it will shine forth as I am this pure consciousness. And you appreciate its limitlessness, its non-duality, its constancy, its problem-free nature. And that's it. Then it's done. Sri Ramakrishna put it so simply. He said, Bodhe Bodh Kara, awareness of awareness, or realization of consciousness in consciousness. In technical terms, he is pointing to the unnecessary reflected consciousness. Reflected consciousness not necessary for enlightenment. All right. The last mantra of this section, number 10. Yam yam lokam manasa samvibhati vishuddha sattva kamayate yangscha kaman tam tam lokam jayate tangscha kaman tasmad atmagyam hi achayet. There's a very poetic and melodious quality to this Upanishad. What's happening in this particular mantra? It's talking about the results of self-knowledge and why the enlightened one should be adored and revered, worshipped, the enlightened one. The man of pure mind wins those worlds which he mentally wishes for and those enjoyable things which he covets. Therefore, one desirous of prosperity should adore the knower of the self. Now, just as in religion, God is adored and worshipped for two things. One is whatever people want, worldly desires. People want, to be cured of illness or to be saved from problems in the world. People want wealth and prosperity and success in learning, in relationships, whatever, in politics, going to heaven after death. All of these are worldly or otherworldly desires. And for that, one worships God. The one who's seeking enlightenment worships God for enlightenment. In just like that, whether one wants worldly success and prosperity, or especially one wants enlightenment, one should adore and revere the enlightened one. One should adore and revere him. It indicates the adoration and reverence for the guru, the spiritual master here. So that's what's being indicated here. Also, the results of enlightenment, and it's put in a very attractive way. It says, so what good is all this? It says, what good is all this is that you get whatever you want. The enlightened one will get whatever he or she wants. So that sounds very nice. That's what I've been looking for. Yeah, you can get all of it, whatever you want in this world, in the next world, whatever you can desire, every world you will get. And in those words, whatever you want, you will get. So that's the result. So it's put in the way, the Upanishad understands our psychology, that at heart we are kids, and we are seeking to satisfy what we want, like impulsive. We want to fulfill our impulsive desires. So it says, yam yam lokam manasa samvibhati, whatever the enlightened one might contemplate, whatever world, human world, the worlds of the fathers, the worlds of various heavens, up to the world of Brahma, kamayate yangscha kaman, and whatever desirable object, whatever it there is, you can available on Amazon Prime. So I'm just joking. One might think that, well, whatever is on Amazon Prime, I can get it too. I don't need enlightenment for that. True. But whatever the means to get anything in this world and in the next world, one has to work so hard in order to earn money. And to get money, one has to earn karmic merit in order to be rich and healthy and well-to-do and good, happy relationships in this world requires a lot of good karma. Now, the enlightened one can have all of that in a blink of an eye, just what is by called sankalpa, by thinking of it. Now, the enlightened one does not want any of it. Why should it? It is all dreamlike for the enlightened one. Then what's the point? Here is the point. Here is the point of the entire mantra. We who are not enlightened, by adoration of the enlightened one, by reverence to the enlightened one, our desires will be fulfilled. So the enlightened one has this capacity of fulfilling the desires, has no desires of his or her own. We might think, what a waste. I've got lots of desires, but without the capacity to fulfill them. And that one has the capacity to fulfill them easily, but doesn't have any of those desires. So Shiva, for example, is depicted as being a yogi without any wealth, doesn't live in a palace, lives on an icy mountaintop, doesn't have a nice sofa to sit on, just has a tiger skin, is dressed in the most austere dress. Shivaratri is coming tomorrow, day after tomorrow. And yet, Shiva can fulfill all our desires. So people worship Shiva for worldly desires. The millions of people who will worship Shiva day after tomorrow, millions, hundreds of millions across India and now across the world also. Not all of them are looking for enlightenment. Very few of them actually are. Many of them are looking for some kind of worldly result. I lived for several years in one of the most ancient, near one of the most ancient Shiva temples. It's called Vaidyanath Dham, in a place called Jharkhand in India, eastern India. So once in a year, there is a huge pilgrimage. And millions of people come there. Millions of people come from all over India, Nepal, and nowadays from abroad to visit that ancient Shiva temple, Vaidyanath Dham. And there is tremendous power there. Those who have gone there, just like many of the ancient pilgrimage sites in India, there is tremendous power. You can feel it. You can just go in there. It's at the last time I went, I think it was last year or year before last, I went there to India and visited because our ashram there completed 100 years and there was a big celebration and we were invited. And we went on pilgrimage to that Shiva temple. Thousands of people, it's very crowded, very noisy. It's not like a Buddhist meditation hall at all, it's just the opposite. There are thousands and thousands of people all the time, ceaselessly. Almost day and night. I mean, only that very late in the night you will find a deep quiet when people are not around. But from well before sunrise to late in the night, thousands and thousands of people from all over India and other countries also. And there is noise and chanting and ringing of bells and people, and rituals and various kinds of rituals going on. There are yogis sitting and meditating, not all for enlightenment. Some are there. I have met some like that. One I knew who was meditating there for intensely, and I thought he was amazing. But it turned out he was meditating for occult powers, siddhis, the ability to read someone's mind, to float up in the air, or so on and so forth. I remember this person, he was extremely austere. And I thought, wow, he's practicing so hard, far more than me. And then one day I heard our senior Swami scolding him very sharply and then sent him away. And we asked later, what happened? He said that young man had come. He was sitting in the temple for the last several months and practicing very intense austerities, meditation. And then finally came very happily and told the Swami this his the extra some extraordinary power he had developed. And the Swami just yelled at him, scolded him so harshly. So there are yogis who are meditating. There are babies who have been brought there for their first tonsure of the hair. There are married couples who have come there for blessings just after marriage. There are Brahmin priests. There are simple villagers from all across speaking various languages. I mean, you just have to imagine the scene in a traditional Indian temple. In the midst of that storm of activity and sound, the whole temple is pervaded by unmistakable spiritual depth. And when you go into the Garbhagriha, the inner sanctorum. It's tiny. And there's a constant shoving and people reaching out to touch the Shivalinga there, which is in the center, and pour water and put offerings there. And you can hardly go there for a few seconds before you're shoved aside and pushed out of the place. But at this time, I did what I usually do there. I go there and do the ritual as quickly as possible within seconds. And as I'm a monk, I'm given a little more time. Then I go quickly to the side, to a corner of that little stone chamber. And then I stand there. You can't sit, you'll be trampled if you sit there. So you can stand in the corner and I repeat the mantra or just try to meditate. And immediately, just like that, in the midst of all that shoving and hubbub and immediate, the stillness and the effortless manifestation of the divine there, that takes place straight away there. And it's unforgettable each time. So, Vibhavati esha atma. So he says, he says here, the enlightened one, people go to these temples for everything, for mostly for worldly purposes, but also for spiritual realization. The enlightened one can grant all of that. Tam tam lokam jayate tangsha kaman. Whatever is comes in the mind of the enlightened one, that one, the enlightened one can get and can give. Can give. That one, does, the enlightened one doesn't want, like Shiva doesn't want any of it. He's constantly granting boons to millions and millions of people for thousands and thousands of years. And none of it, Shiva wants none of it. You can easily grant. And Shiva's another name is Ashutosha, the one who is easily pleased. So easily pleased means just a little ritual, a little prayer, and maybe you will get what you want. So he says the enlightened one is like that. Tam tam lokam jayate tangsha kaman. If the desire which you have, you serve the enlightened one, and if the enlightened one so wants, your desire will be fulfilled. It just has to arise in the mind of the enlightened one. Tasmad atmagyam hi achyayet bhuti kamaha. Atmagya, the enlightened one, self-realized one, the one who has realized the self, I am Brahman, such one, such a one. Achyayet, worship, adore. Bhuti kamaha. Here it says, the one who wants worldly prosperity. If you want enlightenment, yes. If you want worldly stuff, as millions and millions of billions do, even that will be granted if you revere such a one. So that is behind the great reverence shown to sadhus, holy people in India. It's part of the culture in Hinduism and beyond Hinduism, in Buddhism, Jainism, Sikhism, which doesn't have monks, but I've seen Sikhs are so respectful of Hindu monks. So respectful. I've seen this in the Himalayas and in the plains of India. So why? One reason is this one. Atmagyam hi archayet bhuti kama. For those who want something in this world, it could be a pretty worldly desire, but yes, you will. It's possible that you will get it if you revere the holy person. Another way of explaining this is it is said that the enlightened one, the holy one, has got enormous karmic credit because this person has given up evil ways, bad things for a long time, maybe lifetimes, has struggled to become a moral person. So does not do evil, does not do anything wrong for maybe years and decades, maybe even lifetimes. So no bad karma and does good to people, which gives rise to good, really good karma. And worships God, practices spiritual disciplines, which also gives rise to very good karma. And so has enormous amounts of good karma, but which the enlightened one does not want to use. It is nothing to that enlightened one. So what happens is that those who worship the enlightened one, they get the result of that good karma. That's one way of showing from the karmic calculus angle. How is it possible that, fulfilling desires requires you to have lots of good karma? Where does this good karma come from? If you just revere an enlightened one because they are really good people. So they have enormous amounts of good karma. And also the downside of it is if they have any bad karma left over. So those who hurt or malign or act against an enlightened one, they will not do anything. They are absolutely harmless. They will not do anything for to you. They are absolutely harmless. But the vengeance comes from God or from the accumulated bad karma. So those who seek to hurt or malign and a holy person, so the bad karma affects them. And those who revere and serve the holy person, the good karma comes to them. This is from the karmic perspective. From the God perspective, so such people are protected by God. So they don't protect themselves, enlightened ones, they do not protect themselves. They have nothing against anybody. A person could harm them with impunity as far as they are concerned. But never ever try to do that. Be very, very careful around these people because they're protected by divinity itself. The difference is between, in another way, between Shiva and Shakti. So Sri Ramakrishna is to say, you can say whatever you want to me, but be careful of that one. He would point to the Nahabat where the Holy Mother stayed. If she is hurt or annoyed by you, he would say, Brahma, Vishnu, Maheshwara cannot save you. Even the greatest of the gods cannot save you. So Shakti, one should be very careful. So, yes. Atmagyam hi archayet bhuti kama. Those who want enlightenment, they should revere, definitely revere the spiritual master, and they do. But those who want worldly prosperity also, they just have something to attain in the world. It's a very good thing, and very very good bet, wager, because your expenditure is very little and the gain can potentially be enormous. That you see throughout the culture in India, as I said, Sikhs and Buddhists and Jains and of course all Hindus, there's always a culture of revering a holy person. You don't know who is enlightened. Funny story. So a monk comes up, as is even now the custom in Uttaranchal, in the Himalayan regions, in a village, to a household, to a farmer's house on the mountainsides, and begs for food. And the lady of the house goes and gives him food. And the husband doesn't like it. And he yells and says, why are you wasting our food and giving it to these, these holy beggars, these wanderers? They're no good. You're just wasting our food. And she says, it's not wasted. If he is enlightened, then we'll get all the blessings. And if he's a truly holy person, we'll get all the blessings and our desires will be fulfilled and we'll be happy. And if he's not enlightened, then he will become a bullock and plow our fields in his next birth. So there is no meaning, there's no free lunch. So it is on the side of the begging monk. It's incumbent upon him to work really hard at his spiritual practices. Otherwise, he will incur a huge karmic debt from the food he begs from, these poor villagers. Okay. So that brings us to a close of the first section of the last chapter, third chapter of Mundaka Upanishad. Now it remains only the final section remains, which is also a very beautiful section, the concluding section of the Mundaka Upanishad. Quickly look at the comments. Brinda says, it's my mind, it's my understanding, mind is nothing but flow of thoughts. Does pure mind mean that there are no thoughts? Minus thoughts, it's only consciousness. Yes, it is true, but also it's not just thoughts. There are vasanas, what one might today call the subconscious mind, conditioning. Notice, it's not just thoughts. We are susceptible to particular kinds of thoughts, particular kinds of desires and negativities, which are our mind has been conditioned to. So those, only those thoughts, desires, the fixed patterns of thinking, grooves. So the mind is not fresh. It's highly conditioned. Those conditions have to be cleared up. That conditioning has to be purified. How do you know it's purified? Then the thoughts which arise in the mind, spiritual thoughts, positive thoughts will come much more easily. Negative thoughts, worldly thoughts will slowly fade away. The pull of the world will slowly fade away. You don't find it all that interesting or attractive or scary or anxiety producing anymore. So, yes. Girish says, your recent lecture on universe as seeing, is there a parallel to be drawn between Madhyamaka, all things exist only in relationship to others, and Drishti Srishti, existence is only in relationship to seeing? Yes, actually, there's a parallel. They're not saying the same thing. Relationship, existence is only in relationship to seeing. That is much closer to the Yogacara school of Mahayana Buddhism. Yogacara is like the sister school of the Madhyamaka. They're rival sisters. They always fight among each other. The emptiness people and the mind only. Yogacara is the mind only. Vijnanavada, mind only school. And Madhyamaka is the emptiness school. So these two are sort of very sophisticated schools, and they are all living schools because Mahayana Buddhists are practicing Buddhists. Tibetan Buddhists have been developing these philosophies for more than the last 1,000 years. So they're very sophisticated philosophies. And among them, the mind-only school would hold on to this. Existence is in relationship to seeing. Existence is dependent on seeing. But in a different sense than from the Vedantic, Advaitic idea of Drishti Srishti. But the Drishti Srishti of Advaita Vedanta is close to the mind-only school of Buddhism. Everything exists in relationship. That is the emptiness school. So, like two bales of hay leaning on each other, the subject and the object, the seeing and the seen, the hearing and the sound, they lean on each other. Without sound, there's no hearing. Without hearing, there's no sound. Just like this. And by the way, I'm reading right now this book, Carlo Rovelli's Helgoland on quantum mechanics, on quantum physics. And there, towards the end, he goes into Nagarjuna and the emptiness school. He says, when I'm talking about understanding quantum physics as relationships, he says the basic idea, the interpretation of quantum physics, which he favors. And here I'm repeating what he says because I'm far, far from being any kind of having any kind of expertise in quantum physics. So he says that things do not exist in themselves. What are things then? What we call things? What are things then? They are interactions. Things and properties are revealed only in interactions with each other. So that sounds crazy because we think things exist, books, people, sky, earth, all of that exists. He says it exists only in relationship to each other. And he says, when I speak like this, people tell me, have you read Nagarjuna? And he said, finally, I thought I should give it a try. And he read Nagarjuna's the verses on the middle way, the Mula Madhyamaka Karika. And he was stunned. He says, and he read the commentary, he says, with an American analytic philosopher, Jay Garfield, whom I studied Madhyamaka under at Harvard. And he says, I was stunned. This Buddhist master more than 2,000 years ago in India, who is with such clarity talking about what I'm talking about today. Not that, he's very clear. He says, not that the Buddhist master knew quantum physics, not at all. He was not talking about quantum physics. He was talking about the philosophy of interdependence and the empty nature of things. And that's a way to understand quantum physics, the best way to understand quantum physics today, he says. By the way, I was watching a debate among some of the top experts in consciousness studies today. Three experts. The one is Patricia Churchland, another one is Bernardo Kastrup, and third one is Carlo Rovelli, this writer of Helgoland, is an Italian quantum physicist. So three of them. And the first one, Patricia Churchland, her view is consciousness is nothing but the brain, the physical body. The body, nervous system, brain, that generates consciousness. A completely physicalist, materialist explanation of consciousness, or trying to explain consciousness. That's one view. The exact opposite view is held by Bernardo Kastrup. Bernardo Kastrup says he's a computer scientist and also he has got, I think, a double PhD in computer science and in analytic philosophy. So he says there's no physical reality. Physical reality is ultimately mental reality, or it is consciousness. Consciousness itself is appearing as this universe. So an idealist perspective. that the mind is appearing as this universe. So it does not make such a clear difference between consciousness and mind. It is ultimately it's a mental reality. It's mind which is appearing as that. And then you have Carlo Rovelli. He says it's neither matter nor mind. It is relationships. And these things are empty in themselves. All that is these interactions between these empty natured things, if that makes any sense. That's what's creating this universe. All right. So three views. Matter creates this universe. Matter, this universe is matter. Second view, just the opposite. It's not matter, it's mind. And the third view is neither matter nor mind. It is relationships. I was just thinking, who are these people? These are the cutting-edge thinkers in the 21st century world. One is a physicalist, one is an idealist, and one is what? Quantum physicist using the relationships interpretation of quantum theory. Three. Exactly the same positions were held nearly 2,000 years ago in ancient India. There were the materialists, Charvakas, Lokayatas, who held the universe's matter, ever-changing. There were the mind-only school, which we just spoke about. The universe is just mind. And there were these emptiness people, the Madhyamakas, who said the universe is just relationships and empty in itself. In principle, exactly the three positions. Dimitri says, could you elaborate on the reflection? Who is the observer? The reflection, the observer or the subject in our day-to-day interactions right now, the subject, according to Advaita Vedanta, is pure consciousness reflected in or limited by. These are the two theories. Pratibimbavada, Avacchedavada. Two, reflection theory, limitation theory. Pure consciousness reflected in, again, as if. Pure consciousness limited as if by the mind. So, what's the subject? The subject is the mind, I, right now, but illumined by pure consciousness. The subject, really speaking, is pure consciousness. In practice, it is a mind with the reflected consciousness. I'll repeat that. The subject, what you're calling the observer, is really speaking pure consciousness. Without pure consciousness, no observer is possible. But it is in practice, right now, for practical purposes, it is mind channeling, reflecting, limiting that pure consciousness. What is moonlight? What's illumining the earth at night? It's moonlight. Really, it is sunlight. But it is reflected off the moon. It bounces off the moon, as it were, and then comes and illumines the earth. What's the name of the poem? The brain is wider than the sky. Yes. John is asking, in a still mind, awareness is reflected clearly. Then the vrittis arise and modify the mind. The awareness then exists along with the modified mind. Awareness remains unchanged in a modified mind. Viveka arises to discriminate or separate awareness from the vrittis. Is discrimination separating awareness or awareness mind from awareness or awareness from mind? I don't see the difference, but I'll go back to what you said earlier. Still mind awareness is reflected clearly. Yes, but notice you have contradicted it a little later. You say awareness remains unchanged in a modified mind. So is it still reflected clearly or not? Or is it unchanged? You're saying it's unchanged. So that means it's still clearly reflected, and you are right. You're right. Here is a crucial point of difference between Patanjali Yoga and the traditional Advaita. Patanjali Yoga says the stillness of the mind, purity of the mind, and stillness of the mind is essential. And in that still, pure mind, pure consciousness is appreciated for what it is. Therefore, one needs to purify and still the mind in yoga, in samadhi, in yogic samadhi. When you have blanked out the world, when you have lost consciousness of the body, and the mind is stilled like a lake without any movements, in that still pure mind, you, the pure consciousness, you become aware of your clear nature, of your nature as this limitless awareness. That is yoga. Advaita Vedanta is what you say here. He says discrimination between this discernment between the mind and consciousness. So that discernment, it's not stilling the mind. It's quieting the mind. And as Shankaracharya says, dhyayamanah, meditating, he says, anuchintayan, reflecting on or staying with your clarity. Listen to Vedanta, reason it out. Once you've got it, stay with it. This is the discernment or discrimination. My awareness from, I would say the language I would use is awareness from mind, because you are mind, you are awareness, you are not mind. So you see the distinction between yourself and the mind. Right now it's not clear. Right now it seems to be mixed up. Yes, we all claim to be aware, but this is always mixed up with the mind. There is some thought or feeling or an absence of a thought going on. The difference is not clear to us. The clarity will also come in the mind. The clarity will also come in the mind. Pure consciousness is neither obscure in itself, nor does it require clarity. It's always blazing forth. The veiling is in the mind, and the removal of the veil also will come in the mind. And the clarity, I am this, will also come in the mind. But then you are freed of the mind itself. Brahma, Ralph Waldo Emerson, very famous. There are actually verses from Kathopanishad here in that poem, Brahma. Yes, Gita also. Kathopanishad and Gita, same verses. Sonali says, Phalabhyapti is not necessary. Can we say that the reflected consciousness collapses into pure consciousness? Mind goes dark and pure consciousness that we are shines like a dark sun. Yes. That's a good way of putting it. It's very subtle. Those who haven't studied Vedanta and done the discernment, they will find all this language mysterious, what is it trying to say? But when you look inside, see, let me point out something I forgot to point out. The ninth mantra, which we did today, this subtle mind, this subtle Atman, Eshu Anuratma Chetasa Veditabhya, Asmin Prana Panchadha Sambivesha. Here in this body, where the prana, which is fivefold functions, pervades, consciousness pervades the entire mind and sensory system. That has to be realized. The process has been indicated here. I had said I will point out the process, I forgot. The process has been indicated. Start with the body, go to the breath, then to the senses, then to the mind, and then to consciousness itself. So, how do you do that? You sort of relax and then become aware of the body. You can see the body, you close your eyes, you can feel the sensations of the body. Then he says, Yasmin prana, go to the prana. The best way to go to the prana is the breath. Notice the in-breath at the no nostrils. You can start with the stomach, which rises and falls. Then go to even more, go means put your attention, note the inflow of breath at the nostrils, then the outflow of breath at the nostrils. Do this for maybe 10 counts, so the mind also gets steadied. We are interiorizing the mind. We have gone from the world to the body to the breath, prana. Then go from the breath to the senses. Notice the feeling of the warmth in the breath coming here at the nostril, the sensation of the body. And the senses itself. You can even open your eyes and take a look around and notice how forms are being perceived. Then close the eyes again and notice, go from the senses to the mind, the thoughts, the memories, the various ideas popping in and out of existence in the mind. Then notice that you are aware of all of this, that there is the reflected consciousness which pervades the mind and the senses. This is all sentient. This is all happening in awareness. And then go, quote unquote, go from there to the original consciousness, which is you. It's like going from the mirror. First of all, you focus on the mirror, then focus on the face reflected in the mirror, and then go again, quote unquote, go from the reflected face in the mirror to your real face. Like that. Abhijit says, oh, it's a conversation with Ramana Maharshi. The question is, if I also be an illusion, then who casts of the illusion? Ramana Maharshi says, the I casts of the illusion of I and yet remains as I. Such is the paradox of self-realization. The realized do not see any contradiction in it. And it's absolutely clear. Yes, for the enlightened person, this is very straightforward. But for the rest of us, it sounds very contradictory. How can the I, cast off the I and yet remain the I? This is the first line of the Nirvana Shatakam. Mano buddhi hankara chittani naham. In the first line itself, Shankaracharya says, the mind, the intellect, the memory, and the ego, I, is not I. The I is not I. How? Then Bhargava Teja says, as discussing and arguing with my roommate on enlightened person in terms of physical materialistic evidence, I mentioned Brahmakara Vritti and arguing that there should be some kind of physical manifestation in the brain, as every knowledge and thought creates a neuronal path. And you can probably see the evidence of it as a sophisticated tool. Maharaj, do you think it holds any water? It should. Technically, it should. And you'll be interested to know that someone like Swami Trigunatitananda, direct disciple of Sri Ramakrishna, who was in the Vedanta Society of Northern California in San Francisco, he was firmly convinced that the brain, the physical, the brain itself of the enlightened one, of the Jivan Mukta, is there should be appreciable differences in that compared to the brain of the ordinary person. And he said, after I die, preserve my brain. Nobody did that. So they should preserve my brain. So one day scientists will be able to study it. But now we have some indication. So for example, there is a vast amount of literature already in psychology and neuroscience about the effects of prolonged meditation on the brain. And so thanks to the Dalai Lama, who offered some of his advanced Lama practitioners for brain scans, MRI scanning, fMRI scanning. And there is enough evidence now. There are papers and books which have been published. The advanced meditators, those who have been doing serious meditation for years, for decades, you can clearly see it in their behavior, and it seems you can clearly see it in their brain functioning also. So a very significant difference from the average. So if that's true for advanced practitioners, it should be even more true for the enlightened one. If someone does a bad deed unknowingly, is it forgiven by Thakur? Certainly. Always, if we say, I have done something wrong and I confess it to you, my Lord, and I shall not do it. It's important. I shall not do it again. One might say, I might do it again. I don't trust myself. All right. At least promise I shall sincerely try not to do it again. Then also one gets forgiveness. All right. Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Tat Sat Shri Ramakrishna Arpanamastu.